Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
This episode of Politics Without the Boring Bits is sponsored by BT, because BT means business. BT knows that businesses come in many shapes, sizes, and guises, from the person just starting out at their kitchen table to the biggest employer, which is why no matter what line of work you're in, they've got your back to help you succeed and do what you do best. No doubt connectivity is a must in Westminster, and it certainly helped us to get this episode created and distributed to you listening right now. BT already connects more than 1 million businesses and public sector organisations, offering secure and reliable connectivity. Nearly three quarters of people running a business or side hustle feel they couldn't do so without reliable broadband and mobile connectivity. That's why having connectivity you can count on is a must for business, whether it be facilitating multiple devices being connected at once or making team calls or guest Wi-Fi access for customers. BT's connectivity helps keep you and your customers happy. Whatever your business, BT's got your back. Search BT's got your back.
Hello and welcome to the Red Box Politics Podcast in the Times. I'm Matt Chorley. If you're listening to this in the week it was released, and why wouldn't you be? Join us next week at our special live event, Brexit Tamed Live. It's on Tuesday, March the 26th. An absolutely bumper panel of David Ivanovich, Sarah Baxter, Phil Collins, Danny Finkelstein, Lucy Fisher, Katy Perry, Hugo Rifkin, Satnam Sangera, Henry Zeffman, Rachel Sylvester and loads of others, Quentin Letts, and I think we've got Nadine Dorris and Chukwu Amuna to chase around the stage as well. So go to mytimesplus.co.uk to get tickets for that, and you can see us recording the podcast live on Sunday, April the 7th. Go to podcastlive.com for your tickets. Right, plugs over. We're going to sort of talk about Brexit today, but unusually I'm not actually in Westminster in panic mode, which is quite nice. I'm in our News UK building in London Bridge, where I'm delighted to be joined by Hugo Rifkin, Times columnist, who's going to be talking to us about the rise of the far right. Lindsay McIntosh is deputy news editor and has some good news on the fight against breast cancer. But first, this is Alice Thompson talking about the inevitable.
John Bucco loves taking guests around the Speaker's house overlooking the Thames. His favourite part is stroking the astonishing four-poster bed in the staterooms made for the monarch to sleep in the night before the coronation. He sees himself, if not as the king, the arch-modernising kingmaker, bringing in a creche, sorting out expenses and calling out sexism. In fact, he's a bully and a narcissist, more pompous and priggish than many of his ruddy-faced male predecessors. It was astonishing for him to inform the media before number 10 that he was dropping his Brexit bombshell this week. He should have been forced to go last summer when he promised he would. He should go now.
Wow. Have you had this tour then, Alice? Have you been round and looked at the bed?
Yes. Well, actually, I've been round for various LGBTQ events at the Speaker's house, because he's very involved in that. So he's always talking about modernising and about women and about bringing more ethnic diversity and more gender diversity into the House of Commons. And in fact, he says it all, and then he is known to be quite bullying to his staff, although he would dispute that. And he just does love the sound of his own voice.
It was extraordinary that, even by his standards, his statement in the House of Commons on Monday was pretty extraordinary.
Almost extraordinary is that stripy jumper he's wearing at the moment, which I think is quite extraordinary. But he doesn't like being picked up. So today, when people were talking to him, you know, if you get anyone arguing back, he hates it. And that's the thing about the Speaker. They can't really argue back because they all have to be on his side if they want to get called.
Although, actually, I mean, that has been eroded pretty massively. So on Monday, he stood up and he read out, it was about three sides of A4, explaining why he was going to rule out the government bringing back the meaningful vote unless there were substantial changes. And then lots of people stood up and pointed out that he was quite happy to tear up precedent back in January. And now suddenly precedent is king again. But actually there were quite a lot of people who are willing to challenge him. He has basically lost control of the House.
Yes, so Andrea Leadsom, I think, actually, having always never been a huge defender of hers, I do think she's been rather extraordinarily good at going on about it. And she has called him out on various occasions.
spectacular effect. And what do you think, Alice, is the impact on Brexit? On all of this, because obviously some people are very excited, and actually whether or not people agree with what Bucco's done basically is whether or not you agree with Brexit. What do you think?
Yes, so everyone else, the only thing that worries me is that the ERG seem to be quite happy with what he's done, which is surprising because he is known to be a Remainer. Why he's doing this, and everyone's trying to work out what he's done and why he's done it, but it's assumed that he's done it to try and help the Remainers. So it's rather surprising that all the ER, that when you look at people like Jacob Moggs, they're all smiling.
They might just be idiots.
That's true.
My long-running theory about the ERG is that the ERG are sleeper agents on the side of Remain, that everything they do impedes and diminishes the prospects of Brexit. So I reckon that's what's going on. They're just on the other side.
I mean, it's as good an explanation as any other. Lindsay, you were news editing on Monday when, I mean, it was quite quiet, wasn't it? There was basically nothing happening on the Brexit front.
It was. I mean, we felt like there should be some kind of Brexit story that we should be able to tell on the front page because, you know, we're a handful of days out from what is supposed to be Brexit Day, so it really should be on the front page. But I was going into afternoon conference thinking, we've got a few lines that we can put up to the editor. Let's hope he likes them. And then
A little bit samey.
What are the ERG saying? What are the Remainers saying, etc. Sure. And then I think on Sky, on the ticker tape, at about 3:15 or the back of 3, it was announced that Burke was going to stand up and do this statement at 3:30, which, by the way, is when Times afternoon news conference starts. So not ideal timing, thank you. But political editor said, right, I'll text you when you're in conference. I'll tell you what's happening. It could be just a little procedural thing. He could be talking ruling out meaningful vote 3, or he could be setting rules around meaningful vote 4. And I got a message in conference and it just said, he seems to have ruled out meaningful vote 3 unless substantial change. And everyone just sat there and went, what does that mean then? And so all the potential fallout then started to come in.
I think he must be devastated on the front pages of all the papers, don't you think?
He must be absolutely furious because he's always been very keen that the office should be, it's not about him, and it's about Parliament and all of that. Hugo, what did you make? Because there is, I mean, I can't help looking at Burko and just thinking he's a prat, sort of self-indulgent and attention-seeking. But then annoyingly, he does do some stuff which is right sometimes, but then you end up just, he sort of seems to think that being quite good 40% of the time gives him license to be a total pain in the ass the rest of the time.
I mean, I completely disagree. I think people get confused. People conflate the questions of whether John Burko is a nice person, no, and whether he's good at being a speaker. Yes, he is. His decision yesterday, it makes perfect sense. You can't just keep bringing back the same bill again and again and again, going, okay, this time, okay, please. And if you want to do what they've done, which is basically to have this sort of rolling series of votes, you need to set up some kind of mechanism for it beforehand. You need to agree that this is what you're going to do. I think he's got a point. Theresa May, the government, behaved with sort of massive assumption that the processes of Parliament would just do what they wanted them to do. I mean, I don't think in the long term this really makes any difference. They'll find some way to have their vote. They'll tweak it slightly. The same thing will basically happen. But he's done his job, which is to make sure that Parliament runs properly. So fair enough.
I do worry what his overall persona and approach do to the debate, though, because we are so used to kind of this parliamentary theatre, and in particular, you know, he is the kind of pinnacle of theatrics. But if you look at the House of Commons, if you're a kind of an outsider watching it, the theatrical, as I say, approach that he takes almost sort of diminishes it on occasion, particularly when we're talking about something so important about, you know, the economic, constitutional, political future of the country, so close to a deadline date, and he's turning it into a circus. And I don't think that is necessarily conducive to constructive public debate.
No, but that goes back to my first point about whether he's a wanker or not.
But it's beyond whether or not he's a nice person.
I mean, this is how the House of Commons runs. It is how it functions. You know, it almost makes me think of like when all the SNP MPs got in and they were clapping in the chamber and they were told not to. And that, on one level, that's absurd, because why would you not clap in the chamber when you approve of something? But on other, these are the rules of the place. That is kind of how it works. And I think he's doing what his job is meant to be. Everyone always hates the Speaker. The last speaker that anyone people liked was maybe Betty Boothroyd, and only a bit. You know, being the Speaker is being the sort of the point man for the absurdities of the functions of our political system.
I thought one of the best pieces we've had in the Times was the MP going on paternity leave and suddenly realising, as he was on paternity leave, changing nappies, just what a mess the whole thing was.
Bim Mathalamy's wrote a piece of Red Box, and he had 2 weeks off, and he said he couldn't believe how awful it looked from the outside. I mean, to be fair, he did say it felt pretty awful on the inside, but it was even more awful on the outside. Alice, actually, the main point about this Burko row is that it doesn't really matter about precedent and rules and all that. It comes down to maths. Unless or until Theresa May has a majority for something in the Commons, it doesn't sort of matter about whether or not Burko rules it in and out. And if, actually, she does now look like she has a majority, and maybe 50 Tory MPs tell The Times or Con Home or Twitter that they're now on board, Burko then couldn't stand in the way of it.
No, so they can actually do it. So, in a way, that's why it was even more grandstanding from Burko, because he knew it wasn't going to get him very far. He just wanted his name in the papers, really. And I think he felt that no one had really been taking him very seriously for a little bit. And that here he was in the middle of it. You know, he's centre stage, and yet his voice wasn't being heard. So I do think there was a certain amount of that. I also think with Theresa May, you're getting to the stage now when so much money is sloshing around being given to MPs to try and get them to vote, that it's becoming so unsavoury that maybe it was a good idea for Burko just to stop the whole thing for a few minutes.
And so it now means we're in the sort of slightly odd position of probably not a huge amount will happen this week. Having geared up for another extraordinary week in Westminster, we've got the EU Council on Thursday, where we assume that they'll put a new cover on it and maybe change the font, and that will be considered different enough. What do we, obviously not in the predictions business, what do we think might end up happening? We are supposed to be, this is Tuesday morning, we are supposed to be leaving the EU at the end of next week. I've been better prepared to go on holiday at the end of next week. What do we think is going to, let's start with you, Hugo. What do you think is going to happen?
I think her deal in some form with some kind of coat on is going to go through. I've basically thought that from the start. I don't see what else happens. I don't think we are leaving the EU at the end of next week. I think there will be a short delay rather than a long delay. But I think basically something that is to all intents and purposes her deal will go through. The ERG, they've got to get to the point where they realise they're the reason why it's not happening. They're the reason why Brexit might not happen. It's all down to them. You know, I joked earlier that they're this sort of remain sleeper cell. Do I really think they are? No, of course they don't really think they are. That is how they're behaving. At some point, they've got to realise they're the ones who are jeopardising it. And you see, people are starting to slip over to the other side. There was this fantastic exchange on Twitter the other day between Guido Fawkes and Julia Hartley Brewer, where Paul Staines, Guido Fawkes, was saying, you know, I think people should just take the deal now and then, you know, make it a better Brexit once it's happened. And she was going, no, it has to be a proper Brexit. May's deal is basically Remain. And you could see it was basically the sort of two sides of a debate. Like, it was basically half of it realising that the other half that they thought had just been sounding mad for kind of rhetorical effect actually really meant it, and suddenly that was their problem now. You know, and that's kind of the dynamics of it. I think they've got to come round, so I think it will happen.
Lindsay?
Yeah, I mean, I think we're talking short extension. I think when you get into long extension territory, you're obviously heading towards the next set of European elections, which I think is unpalatable to the ERG, even though there's reports in our paper today that they're suggesting, oh, we could stay in and create a bit of trouble inside the EU. I don't think that's going to work, even taking account of what Hugo's been saying about the mad elements of that side of the debate. So I think short extension, some shape or form of her deal, some kind of fudge, gets through, and then that becomes up for negotiation, finessing under whatever becomes the next, perhaps, Tory leader, or indeed the next government.
And Alice, a clean sweep is all going
to
be fine.
I think I have to do the pessimistic version then, don't I? Because I think, I mean, the most pessimistic for me is the general election. I just don't think I could face a third one.
No. So we don't think no deals?
I think no deal probably is off the table now, but I think the idea of another election, I think there will definitely be a leadership election. There'd possibly be two leadership elections. Well, there's going to be one anyway with the Lib Dems. We could have every single party up for grabs in the next year. And I think that
I'm not sure that a Lib Dem leadership election is going to be enough for election addicts.
Yeah, I think we need a clean sweep, don't you? But I think there will be that, and I just can't rule out not having another election now. I think so much has happened in the last 2 years.
It is so broken in Westminster now. You can just, everyone you speak to is completely, it doesn't matter whether they're Remain or Leave or Labour or Tory, or even if you find a Lib Dem. Everything is just so broken, you know, the whipping operation, you know, cabinet responsibility, all of that at some point, the big reset, somebody's got to sort of pull the plug out and turn it off and on again.
I'm waiting for Ruth Davidson because she's about to come back from maternity leave. So she's my last hope, I have to say.
She doesn't want to. She doesn't want to do it. She doesn't want to come here and make everything better. You know, she's happy where she is.
And finally, if Bim spent 2 weeks on paternity leave and thought, wow, this looks bad, I think Ruth's watching it for a few months. There is no way. It's more like she comes back and resigns as Scottish leader and just goes off and does something else. Anyway, I suspect we'll come back and talk about Brexit again next week. But let's move on for now. This is Hugo Rifkin.
There was a time when preachers of violent jihad were considered almost amusing. They were deluded and they were clowns, and it was like they were from another planet. But then, after 9/11 and after 7/7, we learned that even the most absurd of them could and did radicalise people to violence. In the wake of the massacre of Muslims last week in Christchurch, at what point do we come to the same conclusion about the semi-ironic, trolling, clownish bits of the alt-right?
There you go. You've written about this in your column today. It struck me, actually, I hadn't sort of joined up those dots, but I suppose it's the sign of a good column, that you're right. What starts off is a sort of semi-joke thing, snowballing, and nobody can really tell where it... You talk about Milo being one of them. You, I remember meeting him at tech parties and just thinking, oh, he's a bit of a prat, but that was... You know, and now he's had his visa revoked for Australia and he's all part of that sort of alt-right thing. So where do you think it happens? If we can see the parallels of what happened with jihadism, what can we do about it with the far right?
The parallels are kind of the important bit, that you go from this sort of voice in the public domain that a lot of people find to be absurd to this realisation that actually people are being radicalised by this sort of thing. And I think when you're looking at what's happening on the far right... I mean, the shooter in Christchurch, he was so much a product of that kind of that internet subculture. It was so obvious, it was so glaring. That is absolutely where he's coming from. And I think when I'm talking about the kind of the clowns who are inspiring that kind of thing, I'm not directly meaning individuals like Milo Yiannopoulos, although he seems like a pretty nasty person. I mean, it just that culture is a culture that hides... it's not even quite right to say that it hides white supremacism behind humour. It combines white supremacism and humour. It's a bit of a mess of both. It's sometimes ironic, it's sometimes not. But it obviously is inspiring people to behave seriously. There are many, many, many parallels in terms of how identities are formed among jihadists and our new emerging far right. I think we need to be on top of it and spot it. Exactly where we go next, well, that takes us into very difficult and different territory. Essentially, what we're talking about is some form of internet regulation, internet control, internet censorship. It's very, very hard to do, or at least it's very, very hard to do without being massively illiberal. We've been that illiberal with jihadists online. It's quite difficult to be a jihadist online these days. You can communicate sort of surreptitiously, but to be in any kind of public sphere, all the platforms shut you down, and sooner or later, special branch kicked down your door. I'm wary of suggesting we ought to be doing that for essentially far-right trolls, but then maybe that's my own squeamishness. I'm not sure.
Alice, what do you make of this? If there are those parallels, what can be done about it to try and... I mean, it's not even nip it in the bud, because the bud is already... bloomed into something horrific in New Zealand.
Well, the one I was really interested in that Hugo mentioned in his column is PewDiePie, which I didn't actually know about. And then when the gunman in New Zealand mentioned it, I said to my children, just without thinking, do any of you know anything about it, assuming that they wouldn't know much. The 12-year-old not only knows everything about PewDiePie and is totally obsessed by it, but also knew that the gunman had mentioned it already. And he's not particularly obsessed by politics. So it was to me, it was terrifying. And then he said, oh no, he's just, you know, I just watch gaming on there, and he's this very nice sort of Scandinavian, you know, guy on that. And you think, okay, well, how nice is he? So I did start researching it, and I did think, actually, we've let a whole generation of children become very involved with PewDiePie, and it's a lot of their life, and a lot of them are fans of him, and we don't know just how dangerous he is, or whether he's completely innocuous and actually he's just been taken over.
Well, exactly. I mean, so the thing with him, I mean, there was PewDiePie, he was until I think yesterday the world's most viewed or most followed YouTube personality. There was some, I can't remember exactly what it was, there was some directly far-right linked fuss about him a few years ago.
He's made a couple of
it was either about Muslims
horrible
or Jews,
comments,
I can't remember
Jews,
which.
I think, Jews. And apologised afterwards, but kind of made a bit of a joke about it, and it was quite unpleasant.
Right, but the point of him, his prominence, is that there is this sort of, in this sort of strange internet subculture, there is this battle to keep him being the most subscribed person, because the alternative is that it's a Bollywood music label. So it's just this sort of tokenistic, quite silly, pranky, far-right little fight that is exactly the kind of thing that it's very hard to take seriously. It's just stupid kids on the internet. Mm-hmm. But then if that is what manifests into something that someone actually mentions before they go and shoot up a mosque, maybe you need to take this stuff more seriously. Yeah.
And the parents have no idea about it. So actually, most of the parents at the time, none of us, when we talked about it, really knew much about it at all, with our children obviously totally obsessed by it.
I mean, it's popped up on graffiti here, I think, as well. You know, sub PewDiePie, so subscribe to PewDiePie with swastikas on sort of walls in, I think it's Oxfordshire. And yeah, I mean, even if you just consider the guy's name, you know, it's this sort of weird cartoonish sounding name. And then, as Hugo says, it's sort of being mentioned in manifestos linked to the New Zealand killings.
There is still a massive leap between people sharing stuff and saying dreadful things online and then committing a massive atrocity. And because in his so-called manifesto or rant or whatever you want to call it, he refers to all these things, it doesn't necessarily mean that one thing leads to another, does it?
I mean, no, of course it doesn't. I mean, there's the question of where you draw that line is an interesting one. I mean, there's numerous columnists. There's columnists on our paper who are very, very critical of Islam. I think there's a leap between them and, say, somebody like Alex Jones, who shouts on his show about this is a war, fight back, they're coming for you, this is a war. You know, that kind of stuff I'd consider directly incitement. I'm not sure it'd be legal in this country. I mean, the problem when you're getting into the realms of the way this kind of stuff is discussed online and sort of 4chan and 8chan and sites like that, is there's so many levels of irony and humour that it's not quite clear what's sincere and what isn't sincere. And what it boils down to, like a lot of this stuff, like a lot of internet discourse stuff boils down to, the freedom of many voices these days, which generally speaking is a good thing. But it used to be the case that public rhetoric was delivered by a relatively select number of people. Most people couldn't do it. If you wanted to make your voice heard, and you could write a letter to a newspaper and then have to publish it, or you could spray something on a wall. Whereas these days you have, you know, anyone can say anything. And so we're in a situation where we're trying to get a handle on how we can enforce sensible cultural norms of the sort that are relatively easy to enforce when you're talking about a handful of spokesmen or politicians, because they have a face and a stake and a traceable, where how you map that onto literally everybody. And that's really what the problem in dealing with all kind of new forms of internet discourse is, whether it's racism, whether it's hate, whether it's political dishonesty, whatever it is, it all really comes down to that kind of thing.
I thought it was interesting that the New Zealand Prime Minister, the fact that she doesn't want to have the killer's name mentioned, she's not going to mention the killer's name, which at the beginning feels a bit Harry Potter and, you know, yeah. Don't mention Voldemort. But actually, I think she is right. The problem is it's about publicity often, isn't it? And if we can try and stop these people from having publicity and talk about the victims and not try and talk too much about perpetrators, I think it would be beneficial in the end, actually.
And that is true, Lindsay, as well, isn't it, of the manifesto. It's not a private diary kept under a bed that was never meant to be read. You know, there was a purpose to every sentence in it, that it was supposed to be published and dissected and overinterpreted and all of that.
Yeah, and that sort of comes back to Hugo's point as well about, I guess, kind of parity of platform. Now that we have, you know, Twitter that everyone can access on the internet more broadly, so that somebody who is a sort of egg or a horrible far right symbol on Twitter has got the same potential reach, you know, as somebody who is making very coherent, clear points, somebody that is perhaps an elected politician or whatever. So you've got that parity of reach and voice, but then how do we make sure that you know, voices that are spreading hate are tackled without, you know, it's very easy. We're sitting in a very nice newsroom in London Bridge having this discussion, and I'm aware I'm at risk of getting into that sort of liberal elite, as it were, world where somebody's got more right to voice than somebody else.
Why doesn't everybody just think like us?
Well, exactly. I realise that we're getting to that point. So you don't do that, but then perhaps you do what Alice is saying there, which is, you know, you don't use the names, you don't engage, you know, you don't allow any of this to be spread simply in a kind of sort of self-starting power to the people sort of way.
I mean, in terms of that, in terms of like what can be said where, I've aware my views have changed massively quite recently. When you look at things like students, no platforming people, for example, a few years ago, maybe even 2 or 3 years ago, I had very much a traditional centrist dad position on that. You know, yeah. I was like, never did me any harm. In fact, the column I wrote today about all this starts with, I think it was in 1996, hearing Omar Bakri, who's now in jail in Lebanon, addressing the Cambridge Union, you know. And I was like, that is a good thing for students to do. Whereas I now realise that people much younger than me understand with an, in a sort of instinctive way that I don't, that everybody has a voice, that there's not really any such thing. Like, no, when you no-platform somebody these days, you are not shutting them up. You are altering their prominence. You're altering their endorsement in a way that really, I think people of my sort of generation and older, we slightly struggle to make sense of that. But actually, if you tell someone they can't talk at the Cambridge Union, they don't disappear. They're not silenced. They don't fail to be able to speak to the same sort of people. They're just not endorsed. They're just sort of not endorsed by doing that. And so we have the same sort of issue with people like this shooter. I approve of the idea of politicians not saying his name. I didn't use his name in my column. I had qualms about whether I should even be writing about his manifesto, because he obviously wanted people to. Mm-hmm. I mean, what I was really deciding there was whether his manifesto deserved to be in the Times, not whether people should be able to read it, because people are going to be able to read it anyway. And it's a whole different set of kind of speech and political calculations that are really unfamiliar.
And at a very basic level, that kind of goes back to before we had these platforms, when you just had this guy who was, with these extreme views, who, to use Hugo's example, was sort of scrawling on a wall or was sending green ink notes to newspapers, they could be ignored. And in the same way, I suppose he was the guy who was ranting in the corner of a pub, and people endorsed him by their feet by sitting on the other side of the bar or leaving the bar and not, not engaging with him.
I do think the younger generation are just getting much more savvy than we are. You look at it and you look at how they're doing climate change and how they're using their voice, actually, I think is quite clever. I think that they are saying, this is what we want to hear, this is what we don't want to hear. They're not saying, no point in using your iPhone, they're engaging with it in a new and different way.
But there has definitely been a shift in attitude towards the likes of Facebook and Google and Twitter. That not that long ago, I mean, even politicians wouldn't criticise them because they would be seen to be sort of stuffy granddads, whereas Facebook was all people in T-shirts on hoverboards in, in sunny Silicon Valley or whatever. Whereas now there is quite a hard push by politicians to do more with social media. Is it just that everyone's growing up a bit about
Yes, but I think our generation have this sense of, all children shouldn't be on social media, and, it's appalling, and, their brains are being changed by it. And actually, I think they are being more sensible. They're saying, it's great technology. How can we use it? What should we be using it for? We're not all having breakdowns if we use it. It's just how you use it and how, don't let yourself be manipulated by it. And I think that's quite interesting, actually.
But the idea that the internet isn't a free-for-all, I mean, no other industry is a free-for-all. If you want to manufacture things or sell things or provide any other sort of service, you are regulated.
Well, it's a point I've made a few times that when you look at social media, particularly, social media is an American export. It's the export of an American product, and the product that America is exporting is the American notions of free speech. It's the First Amendment. And so what it does, America was built for that, but you have American free speech that basically comes crashing into every other jurisdiction, and it messes up our politics because we have a slightly different notion of free speech, and it does catastrophic things in places like Burma, where free speech has just never really been on the agenda. It causes genocide in places when you have American notions of free speech coming crashing in. And so it's not so much that it's outside the law; it's just according to different laws that aren't our laws.
Well, we've run out of time on that, but it is absolutely fascinating, and I'm sure it's something we'll come back to, both the terrible events in New Zealand, but also the wider question of free speech. Coming up after the break, Lindsay's got some good, nice, positive news for us to end on. We'll be back after this short break.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Looking for inspiring stories? Listen to the EY Leading Into Tomorrow podcast, It features compelling stories from leaders across government and the public sector who've transformed their organizations and services. From the impact of grants to how digital innovation is reshaping affordable childcare, you'll get actionable insights and ideas that can be used around the world. Download Leading Into Tomorrow by EY wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back. You're listening to the Red Box Politics podcast from The Times, and this is Lindsay McIntosh.
So I bring good news. There's a study from Milan, which is released, that shows that breast cancer death rates are falling in Britain, and they're falling faster than elsewhere in Europe. And when we debate about how terrible things are at the moment, as we should, and how bad things are going on, I think we need to remember that the world and the country is getting better in some areas, and that's happening because of decisions that have been made, because of clever people looking at problems and affecting change and trying to deal with those problems.
Lindsay, this was on the front page of the Times on Tuesday, partly because it was some nice positive news alongside the great big scary picture of John Bercow. But also, we sort of, while we're totally obsessed with what's happening at Westminster, we sort of forget there's another world going on. And this was probably a study that was announced several years ago, and people who are much cleverer than any of this in this room have been beavering away. And lo and behold, some positive news comes out of it.
Yeah, so this problem tracks back decades. I mean, Britain has performed really quite badly in cancer treatment and also in terms of number of cases of cancer, and there have been reasons for that going back decades. And people, as you say, that are much cleverer than us decided to tackle that, and they did it through a lot of different interventions. So they did things like awareness campaigns, they improved screening, they invested lots of money into research and studies and produced better treatment. And as a result of all of this, as we see some sort of 30 years down the line, and in particular in recent years, death rates are falling in Britain.
So the average death rates predicted for this year compared to 2010-2014, down 18%.
Down 18% in Britain, and that compares with 9% kind of on average across Europe. And one of the reasons is that we did start from a much higher point.
Is it because we were just not very good at it before?
Part of it is that we weren't very good at it before, but we have improved faster than you would expect us to have done in other countries.
Alice, this is some nice, welcome, cheery news, isn't it?
Yeah, I think with breast cancer in Britain, we were so low that in a way we had to do something about it, because, and also because it was considered to be, it is a female death, and that it was seen to be an area that we just hadn't focused on, and we was focusing far more on other issues. And I think that there are very few areas during Brexit that actually have really seen any good news stories in different departments, because people are so worried about a no deal. Whereas I think with breast cancer it has, and you know, everyone has regular screenings now. They've taken up much more, and there has been some debate about whether or not it's good to have so much screening, because you sometimes pick up false negatives or false positives. But in general, I mean, all my friends and I definitely, you get to a certain age and you definitely now do it. And my mother's generation never did that, even people 15 years older than me.
And what do you think is behind that shift? Because it's not just more leaflets from the doctor, is it? Is it a cultural thing?
No, and you get more reminders, and it's happening more often, and it's younger. And they also, what they've been very clever at is looking at history. So they look at the history of, you know, I've never been asked until recently, but now I'm asked what my grandmother's history was, my mother's history was, whether I have aunts, sisters, anyone who's got a history of breast cancer. So they are actually looking to see what those are. And if they're all being flagged up, you are then going to have a chance, actually, to see if you've got particular genes or... And I think that makes a huge difference. I think knowing what diet does makes a huge difference. We suggested it might have something to do with HRT, but I'm not sure that's been proven yet, is it?
I think that we do suggest that there is a link, because we have, I think we've reduced our reliance on HRT in this country, and so has Germany. I think there have been changes related to that.
Because it's always very difficult with any health issues to know what to do and what not to do.
There's so many
conflicting stories.
Yes, exactly.
So there's always conflicting stories about take this, don't take that. But this one, they're literally, I think everything's come together. You do need screening. You know, you do need to eat more healthily. You should be looking at your family background. And I think all that together is produced
It's really interesting, I think, as well, to sit it beside cervical cancer at the moment, because we have a real problem just now in this country. I'm sorry to get back to bad news, but we have a big problem in that cervical cancer rates are going up, screening uptake is going down. And I think what can be done is sort of lessons can be learned from breast cancer, and perhaps some of the measures which were taken to tackle the problem that we have with breast cancer can be done with cervical cancer. And I've certainly seen, you know, I get text messages all the time from the doctor saying, you know, have you come in for your screening test? And I think we've seen there's a big advert that's running on TV at the moment promoting going along for screening. So
in fact, Theresa May's more than once talked about it in the PMQs, because I think she knows it's another way of getting that message across. So she's talking about it and saying she should go and do it.
What we mustn't do then is forget male cancers as well, because there's going to be this huge upsurge in women being tested. But you do have to look at men, who actually are worse at going to their GPs if they have a problem than women are.
So the stats say that overall cancer deaths have fallen twice as fast in men in recent years, but they are still 60% more likely to die of the condition.
I think a lot of that is to do with social issues and things like smoking and drinking. So I think men obviously started from a very high point of smoking and drinking, and they tackled that to an extent, and therefore the cancer rates came down. But women were sort of late adopters of such habits, which had an impact on cancer rates there.
Hugo?
No, I've just been learning a lot. I don't really have sort of much to add on that. I mean, I'm aware women are much better at going to the doctor than men are. And it's, you do wonder how, whether our kind of our breast cancer rates were so high because of a sort of historically male dominated medicine or something like that, and it's part of a general social change. But no, it's just great, and I'd rather just listen than talk.
I think
might be a first for columnists on the podcast. Well, in fact, we talked about this a couple of weeks ago on the podcast. I think it was in the week of International Women's Day, by coincidence, but we had Caroline Criado Perez on talking about her book, which is fascinating, about how basically all data is skewed towards men. And so in lots of ways, research is always done about the male body, and then the female body is tacked on afterwards. So particularly things like breast cancer, cervical cancer.
We had some really interesting stories in on the day of International Women's Day, actually. And one of them was about research which showed that certain drugs, particularly drugs that have been around for a long time, like statins, may not work in the same way on women as they do in men, because women are less likely to be involved in the original trials. And there's reasons for that. So a lot of the trials are led by male researchers who perhaps have a bias to recruiting male guinea pigs. Perhaps women aren't so willing to come forward. And the guys behind this research, which I think was maybe the Netherlands, said that it should be a regulation that you have to have women that take part in the studies.
It was absolutely, the stuff that Caroline had was absolutely extraordinary. She even talked about a sort of a seatbelt adaptation for pregnant women, so to put your seatbelt man, and that was tested on a male-shaped dummy in car, you know.
I think her book's been the most seminal book I've read this year, actually, and I think all men and women should read. So I always thought I was really, really bad at filling up the car with petrol. I just thought, and I never mentioned it to anyone, it was just one of those embarrassing facts that I couldn't fill up the car particularly, and I was trying to dodge it, and it wasn't...
In what way? You're sort of spraying it all over the
side. Well,
it
just never really worked. The nozzle never worked. It was always slightly awkward. It always stopped and started, and I kind of assumed...
I'm confused. You would remember to do it.
I would do it. I didn't mind paying
just,
for it instead of my
putting
husband.
The nozzle in just
but
didn't
when,
make
once
it
the nozzle
work.
In, I'd have to repeatedly squeeze it. And then you suddenly realise in our book that the nozzles are all made for male hands.
Oh, I see.
Really,
so literally the size of it.
Yes. So it's all to the size. So I read the book and I said to my husband, do you have a problem? He went, what are you talking about? He said, just fill up the car with petrol. So I said, right, you can do it.
I know.
It's made for you.
After our episode went out a couple of weeks ago, there ended up being a massive conversation on Twitter in response to one of the tweets about mobile phones, because mobile phones have got bigger and bigger and bigger, but they're, you know, only actually men with quite big hands can hold them. And actually loads of women who were listening saying, I just couldn't work out why I kept off my phone in order my male friends would do it.
You feel more clumsy. And the other one is every time you get on a train, you can't put your luggage up. So you have to ask a man to put your luggage up. And you realise now that they were all made for men. So you see, Hugo, it'll change your life.
No, well, I'm just sort of thinking, I mean, the experience, for me, as a man, a lot of the experience of having children is lifting stuff. And I mean, my life, like as in my kind of sort of 20s and early 30s, I didn't really lift stuff. And now I spend my whole time lifting stuff. And the amount of my kind of my role as a parent, which is just carrying, pulling, fetching, being the person who can lift this up to there. So I think it'd be great if all this stuff was built more for women, so I could lift less crap.
Not least because you and I have jobs which don't involve a lot of physical lifting during the day. So we're not really, we're no more adept at lifting heavy stuff in sheds than anyone else. I think we've run out of time, I'm afraid. I'm glad it's nice to finish on a nice positive note, though. Don't forget, you can subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, Acast, Spotify, or wherever you listen. Get your tickets to Brexit Tames live at mytimesplus.co.uk, or the tickets for Podcast Live are at podcastlive.com. Sign up to my morning email at thetimes.co.uk/redbox. But for now, my thanks to Alice, Lindsay and Hugo. For me, Matt Jawley, it's goodbye.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Looking for inspiring stories? Listen to the EY Leading Into Tomorrow podcast. It features compelling stories from leaders across government and the public sector who've transformed their organizations and services. From the impact of grants to how digital innovation is reshaping affordable childcare, you'll get actionable insights and ideas that can be used around the world. Download Leading Into Tomorrow by EY wherever you get your podcasts.